Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and this is the beginning of part three of our Hugh Nibley series. We've had really great discussions already on Hugh sort of framing his life and his career and just the different biographical things. And then we had a wonderful discussion that we released on Monday, the 26th, and that was about Hugh's scholarship, his approach to the ancient world, parallels within Mormonism, criticisms of some of that approach to studying religions, and also some of the criticism about his footnotes. But we end up really, I think, having a terrific assessment of Hugh as scholar and defender of the faith. And in this one, I think, is going to be our most fun one in some ways. And this is the Hugh Nibley that, you know, when you kind of see him as just defender of the faith or things like that, you can sometimes forget that he had, well, it's impossible to forget that he had great wit. That is for sure. But it's sometimes easy to forget that he occupied this very, very interesting position within Mormonism of a person who had zero status in terms of callings or whatever. I think being a BYU professor certainly has some kind of status and things like this, but he wasn't in the church hierarchy at all. And yet he was very influential and able to say things and still be a trusted voice within Mormonism, even though he was very, very critical of not only the wider culture, but some of the things going on within the church. So this will be our one on Hugh Nibley as social critic, activist, somebody whose voice is just crying out against things that he saw going wrong in society. So I'm thrilled to have Boyd Peterson back with us. Boyd, thanks for being our stalwart for all three of these episodes. Would you remind everybody a little bit about your background?
Thanks for having me again. I teach English here at Utah Valley University, and I'm the program coordinator for Mormon Studies. So I get to do all the Mormon Studies programming here. And my claim to fame is the book that I did on Hugh Nibley, A Consecrated Life, that was published back in 2003. So that's kind of my background.
Appreciate it. Thanks for coming back again. Randy Paul, you've been on the podcast, oh, I'm guessing more than six or seven times. You're always a favorite. People always tell me how much they enjoy your voice, and we're thrilled to have you back here. Would you give us a little bit about your background and maybe just an angle on Hugh and why we probably grabbed you for this one?
Yes, I'm born and raised in New Jersey, came to BYU, met Hugh Nibley at BYU in the late 60s. I currently work as the president and founder of the Foundation for Religious Diplomacy, soon to be known, we trust, for the World Table, which is a new internet platform we'll be launching this fall that helps people engage in honest but difficult discussions with people they disagree with. The background for me with respect to Hugh Nibley would be that he was very instrumental in pushing me in the direction of what might be called intellectual spirituality. I was raised to think that you had a spirituality meter that went to the highest point when you started weeping, and that feeling always was more real and true than any thought you had or any systematic way of thinking that you might create, a kind of subtle, if not direct, anti-intellectualism. Hugh Nibley, by being in his very presence, feeling the spirit in his room and around him when he was talking in very deep and powerful ways that required intellectual work, taught me by that experience that, you know, you could get to the conviction of truth in many, many modes.
Nice.
And so that, he was very important to me that way.
Cool.
I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, and we'll unfold the rest because I know that you had some interactions later in your career and things too. So,
Yeah,
we've had enough conversations, you and I, and Hugh comes up enough that I knew you would be great for this episode. So thank you so much. Russell Arben Fox, welcome to Mormon Matters Podcast. We're thrilled to have you for the first time on the show. I know you're going to be well known as a blogger and interactor on online forums, but would you give people a sense of what you do for a living and eventually get us a little bit of a taste of your Hugh Nibley angles?
Yeah. Thank you for inviting me, Dan. So I run the political science program at a small Christian liberal arts school called Friends University in Wichita, Kansas. I've been here since 2006. I've been blogging on and off about Mormon matters since, I guess, 2003 is when I first started at Times and Seasons, went over to By Common Consent in 2008. I am the book review editor for Dialogue. I did not come out of BYU thinking that I would spend much of my career thinking about Mormon issues or thinking about issues from a Mormon perspective. That was obviously something that I did while I was a BYU student. Just about every intellectually engaged person at BYU at one point or another is consciously or unconsciously making use of a Mormon perspective to critique things within their discipline or advance ideas within various research projects they had. But once I left BYU, I just didn't think I would be doing much of that anymore. Gradually, through blogging and through other venues, I got drawn back into the Mormon studies world. And that gave me an opportunity to reacquaint myself with Hugh Nibley. I was not a Nibley file when I was at BYU. I was aware of him. I was curious about him. I was fascinated by him. I read much that he wrote. And, you know, there are interesting stories we can share in that connection. Somebody had put together this random collection of Hugh Nibley quotes, and they Xeroxed it off, and it was floating around my mission. And different elders would grab on to this, you know, Nibley errata, and sometimes there'd be attempts to translate some of that into Korean and make use of it in the mission field, which was always a catastrophe. But I mean, it was attempted anyway. For a little while, I sat in the back of one of Hugh Nibley's Book of Mormon classes. I was just curious. I wasn't in the class. I didn't need to take the class. I just wanted to hear him speak. I wanted to catch a little bit of his flavor and his style. I was heavily involved in the Student Review, and there were some people at Student Review that knew Nibley quite well, that worked as his research assistants at times, and they would share various stories, perspectives on Hugh Nibley. My father read Approaching Zion at some point during the 1990s. I don't remember exactly what prompted him to do this, but he knew that I knew people who knew Hugh Nibley and that I'd had run-ins, you know, with his groupies. And he wanted to share with me some of his thoughts. And those were some very productive conversations. And they came back to me. All of this stuff came back to me as I got re-engaged in Mormon studies over the past decade or so. Hugh Nibley's ideas are massively important to how I currently situate my thinking about God's will, my thinking about the message and the purpose and the history of the church, and my thinking about economics and politics.
Awesome.
I think that he is a profound theorist of politics, by no means a comprehensive or thorough one. His political and economic ideas are often undeveloped, if not half-baked, and buried in all sorts of different essays scattered around. But if you read him with sympathy and consistency, then you will find a profound theoretical message there. I think I believed this way, way back when, but I never felt obliged to kind of flesh out those ideas until I found myself pulled back into Mormon studies in recent years. And I'm glad of that because it's allowed me to focus on the meaning of Nibley and the meaning of Nibley's social critique in my life and my philosophy. So more than you needed to know.
We're excited to have you. Thrilled to have all three of you here. And as we were kind of gathering some thoughts ahead of time, I threw out to you guys a framing for this one, and all of you seem very comfortable with it. It's certainly not new language. I know, Russell, you wrote a thing upon Hugh Nibley's death where you used the term that we're going to introduce here. And so what I'm trying to get at, and before I say the phrase, is there's this weird position that Hugh was able to occupy. He's not a leader of the church, but he's very influential within the church, and yet none of it came from authority except for his own words, except for the power of his own teaching, etc. And so this term, it's a term in religious studies. Max Weber, the great German sociologist, would talk about it, and it's basically the term prophet. And the reason I'm like worried about this term as we introduce it here is that within Mormonism we have this definition of prophet that is so tied up with the president of the church these days that it's lost some of the cachet or some of the extra flavor that it has out there in the wider world when you call somebody a prophet. So, for instance, out in non-Mormon circles, it would be very common for somebody to say, Martin Luther King, we're here on the 50th anniversary of I Have a Dream, spoke with a prophetic voice. He was certainly for many people a prophet and things like that. There's the great Simon and Garfunkel tune, Sound of Silence. It talks about the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls and tenement halls. And this wider use of the term prophet is the idea of somebody who is not in the maintenance of the status quo stuff, who sees things, who says things, who's able to at least be heard and influential. He often will never quite win the day in terms of seeing all the changes, but yet people recognize him, and slowly social shifts and certainly personal lives do change, but often the institutions are much slower behind that prophetic voice. But it was important that this prophet crying out from the wilderness, coming in from the cold, saying his piece was this. And so that's the term that we've chosen to talk about Hugh Nibley. Anybody with a reflection on that? Boyd, how widespread is this to call Nibley a prophetic voice?
Well, actually, Eugene England did it back in, this would have been 1998, I guess. He was reviewing a series of books that Hugh had written that had come out at that time, and he published an article called Hugh Nibley as Cassandra in BYU Studies, and he said that...
That's right, that was a great piece, yes.
That was a really remarkable piece, and he said, he made a distinction that I liked. He said that Nibley was the finest lay as opposed to officially called prophet of the Latter-day Saint people. And he went on, he says, I'll just quote a little bit here, I think this is really good. He says, Nibley most perceptively describes our sins, most courageously and persistently calls us to repentance, and most accurately predicts our future if we will not repent. And so, you know, very much using that same kind of a Weberian kind of idea of prophet that you are referring to. Gene England was doing that back in the late 90s. So I don't think it's unprecedented at all.
Yeah, and then it's so interesting you mentioned Gene England. I'm looking here in front of me at a 1987 piece by Orson Scott Card, which is a review of Why the Church is as True as the Gospel by Eugene England. And Card is very explicitly calling both Hugh Nibley and Eugene England prophets in sort of this same sense. So it definitely is out there. Randy, from your wider reading on the cultural use of the term prophet and how appropriate it is for Hugh, is there any quick thoughts that you have?
I understand and am very much in agreement with the description that has been given. However, I think Hugh Nibley would balk at it. I think he saw himself more like Antony giving the funeral speech for Caesar. I'm not here to praise Caesar. No siree, not me. I'm just here to bury him. I think Nibley was an ironist, and so he would never come out and say anything like he's being a prophet here. Or he wouldn't give you, you had to read him a lot, I think, to get the essence of what has been described here. Those who would hear him speak or read just one article of his wouldn't sense that he was in any way self-absorbed with a mission
right.
to change the church or to change the brethren or to change anything. What I call his miraculous influence came through his hobbit-like demure status among the typical members of the church who thought he was this an egghead intellectual who didn't know much about what he was saying. And there's something about him that tells me if he were on this conversation with us, he'd say, "Oh, let's not talk about this. You know, let's."
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't, and it isn't just modesty; it's method. It's method. He knew in Mormonism you did not want to go directly to the prophetic mode in the traditional sense, or in the Mormon sense. You just, if you didn't have the calling, quote unquote, you weren't going to have the power to do that kind of thing. And yet he found a way to have power, and we'll be talking about it, I think, today.
Right. Awesome.
Deep, long-term power. Here we are talking about him. I'll just leave it at that. I think we'll fill that in.
Good. And Russell, I want to go to you in a second. Boyd, I want to hear, though, it was Randy right about this, his speculation that Hugh, because I'm sure some people threw this at Hugh when he was alive. Did he deflect it in ways that Randy said he might?
Yeah, I think he would deflect it. I mean, you know, it's kind of like that that line about how you know, you can't be modest if you're you know, the only person who's humble is somebody who can't admit that they're, you know, not humble. So you have to be humble. And I think he was very humble about that. But at the same time, you know, I think he saw himself in, he seemed to perceive a sense of calling in doing this. And, you know, even a letter from the 1940s where he was writing home to his mother, he says, you know, "I speak in a prophetic vein," he says.
Hmm.
But he says the reason for that is because he called it the signs of an impending readjustment in the face of the whole earth are fairly close. So he saw that, you know, this sense of, this was a final warning that he was giving, and he seemed to have a pretty keen grasp that, you know, things weren't headed in the right direction and we needed to get on course. So yes, I don't think he would admit to being a prophet, but at the same time, I think he understood that he had a kind of prophetic calling.
Interesting. I think that's a good way. That's a good way to frame it.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Boyd. I didn't mean to say that he didn't see himself as having the calling to do the prophetic thing. I'm just saying his method was one that was very indirect, in my judgment. It's not the typical way you'd see a prophetic voice in the Mormon church. You think of most Mormon think people today would say the prophetic voice is probably on the progressive side of the church, out there clipping where they can at the standard general authority speech or whatever it is that's got the Mormons stuck in the rut. And Hugh Nibley would never go there. You'd never find him criticizing any one of the brethren. He had a different way. His method was, again, we'll go there maybe later on in this discussion, but that's what I was going to add. Method, not his purpose. His purpose was prophetic.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And I think, you know, in terms of his need to correct culture, he never acted like he was correcting the church. He seemed to be very clear that it was a cultural thing. And in fact, when he would make comments, he was always referring to scripture and general authorities. I mean, he always backed up his words with, you know, other prophetic utterances. So he was not, you know, he wasn't just out there being a gadfly. He was being a critic in a bigger sense, I think. So, yeah, good points.
Good. Russell, just some general thoughts on why you chose that term prophet when you wrote up your blog post on his death, and just the wider use of that term.
The only thing that I would add to, you know, the very capable expressions of Boyd and Randy is that, you know, when you talk about Hugh Nibley's rhetoric often being ironic or indirect, I see him very much sometimes as a bit of a holy fool, a bit of the court jester. He's the one that speaks truth to power by finding snarky ways, by finding unexpectedly humorous, but then upon reflection, kind of embarrassingly incisive ways to bring things
Amen.
Up. He was a truth
Amen.
Teller. The basic idea of a prophet is that of a truth teller. The prophet is the one who has the insight that cuts against the ways of the society, the community, the church, the nation, the government, the business, whatever. There is a very strong tradition in history and literature of the truth teller being, you know, the person who's not in the position of power, the person who's a little bit slovenly dressed, the person who, you know, is at best a bit of a gatekeeper. He's the doorman. He's the wise man that doesn't dress like the wise man, doesn't talk like the wise man. We understand that these people making their snide comments, making their underhanded observations can be a source of truth. And I have no idea, you know, how Nibley would have responded to a point blank question about, you know, his own prophetic role. He was so well read that he couldn't possibly have recognized the fact that a lot of the time his rhetorical slipping in of the stiletto is downright prophetic, in the same way that, you know, the fool talking to Lear is a prophetic voice in his own way.
Great stuff. I love this holy fool stuff. And, you know, I thought of it myself ahead of time, Russell. And one of the questions I wanted to pose to Boyd, in our earlier discussion, we would talk about Hugh's disheveled clothes and sort of his manner and this. And, you know, there's the prototypical absent-minded professor, head in the clouds kind of thing. And so there's a part of me that senses that it's not deliberate, but it does sort of feed into the trickster, court jester, holy fool guy on the side stuff. Boyd, do you think there was anything deliberate about Hugh's clothing other than just coming out of the critiques that we're going to talk about?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to say there was anything deliberate. I just don't think he thought about it. But it certainly played up to that. I mean, the one thing that you had to say about him is he did not take himself seriously. He, you know, for somebody who was taken seriously by a lot of people, he never put much stock in it himself. And in fact, one of my favorite things he said was, he said, you can't take the gospel seriously and yourself seriously and vice versa. And, you know, I thought that was really a profound idea. And
Where was it that Hugh Nibley wrote, I don't even trust anything I wrote more than 10 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
That was a Sunstone essay or something
that
like that?
That was a response to Ed Ashmont. We talked a little bit about that one last time. But yeah, Ed Ashmont kind of blindsided him on a scholarly piece that he'd written and asked Hugh to respond. And Hugh's response was, well, why do you think I'd be upset at this? This is the way scholarship's supposed to go. Don't hold me responsible for something I've written 5 years ago. That's silly. And so, yeah, he never took himself very seriously. He was always... I mean, some of the funniest family gatherings were things where he would just do really kind of funny, bizarre things. One time we caught him, he picked up the vacuum hose and it had come unattached from the vacuum, and he was speaking into one end and holding the other one up to his ear. And Zina asked him what he was doing, and then she got a little closer, and he was saying, oh, deep fount of all wisdom, tell me the truth. He always, you know, really had a good laugh about things. And so, yeah, I think the holy fool thing is absolutely spot on with him. I don't think it was an act, but I think it was just the way he was.
Can I share one holy fool anecdote, just because it's the one really good Hugh Nibley anecdote I have? Okay, so the first year Melissa and I were married, we were in a ward just south of the BYU campus, and it was Hugh Nibley's ward. And Melissa and I sang in the choir, and it was the Christmas sacrament meeting, and Hugh Nibley had been asked to speak. And our choir director had come up with this wonderful cantata that she was very, very proud of. And Hugh Nibley, you know, got up to the microphone to give his address and spoke in a marvelous wavering fashion for the next 25 minutes, cutting way into the choir's time. And those of us sitting in the choir seats could never entirely hear him correctly because when I say wavering, he was literally waving at the pulpit. He would kind of lean towards the microphone, and all of a sudden he was like, and the evidence for Santa Claus coming from the, and then he was gone again. Then he would come back a moment later, and then this is validated by the Egyptian practice. And then he was gone again, and it was fantastic. And our choir director was kind of sitting there silently weeping, and it was just a wonderful moment. Sorry, I have no idea if that story stands up to any kind of scrutiny.
Before we leave the holy fool thing, Boyd, your mention of the Eugenian calling Hugh as Mormonism's Cassandra reminded me that maybe a lot of our listeners won't know who Cassandra is, and she had both a blessing and a curse. Would you remind people who Cassandra was? And then, Randy, I'd love any reflection that you would have afterwards on whether Hugh truly was listened to or not, the way Cassandra had that challenge.
Cassandra was a Greek character. She was the daughter of King Priam, and she was blessed with, she was so beautiful, she was blessed with this gift of prophecy, but the downside was that nobody listened to her, and so she'd walk around prophesying things, but nobody would pay any attention, and so that's why Jean would make this comment that, you know, Hugh was this great prophet figure, and yet nobody really was listening to him. And so it was kind of a double curse, you know. He's cursed with the prophecy, but cursed with not listening.
Right, right.
Not only was she not listened to, but the problem with Cassandra was she knew the future in detail, and like most humans, she knew the good and the bad of the future, and the bad was always more impressive to her than the good. And so she was always depressed and miserable, not that only that people didn't want to hear the bad news that was coming down, but that she knew it in advance. And she ended up committing suicide. It's a fascinating thought that if you knew everything, you'd prefer not, because you tend to know the bad versus the good. And this is something that Hugh Nibley, I think, was very much not Greek in his prophecy. He was very Christian in the sense that he had this optimistic belief in the power of love and Christ, even though the whole earth was going to go to hell in a basket, even though he knew, you had a sense that he knew things were imminently going to be bad, there was something in him, almost impishly in him, that said, but don't let that go get you down. I have overcome the world, Christ speaking there. In other words, he wasn't a Jesus freak fundamentalist, but almost anything he said was underscored by this optimistic view that the love of Christ would conquer all in the end. So, yes, he was a Cassandra, but not the kind of Cassandra that the Greeks would have known.
Now, I do, when like early on in your response there, you said, yeah, nobody listened to him. Let's qualify that, because clearly we've already mentioned the word nibliophiles. We already listened to lots of people. We know that there are out there plenty of people who, you know, their whole take on economics and capitalism or, you know, anti-war, environmentalism, there's lots of people who have changed their life based upon hearing Hugh's message. But in some ways, when you say nobody listens to him, it's like we probably haven't seen the large-scale changes in church culture or the world culture that you might otherwise see. Is that a fair statement for you guys?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I think he affected many people deeply. But there's a funny statement that he made in a private letter where he said, you know, everybody, when they hear me speak, they nod their heads and they think, oh, yes, that's exactly true. And they see the faults of their, you know, neighbors in what I say, but they never see the faults in themselves. Mm. And so, you know, that's another kind of Cassandra-type moment. He's speaking, you know, in some ways calling everybody to repentance. One of my favorite conversations was with a person who said he could not understand why people thought Nibley was anti-war. I was just dumbfounded. I thought, well, maybe because he was anti-war. but, you know, you tend to read things out of things that you want to see, and a lot of his, you know, biggest fans did not see themselves in his social criticism at all.
Interesting. Russell, any thoughts on that, like whether was he heard or not? You said that you heard him, but you also said something really interesting in your Times and Seasons little in memoriam about him, is that, you know, his stuff was there and it was powerful, but it was so impractical that it probably just part of the thing was, how in the heck would you implement this?
I think that there is a connection that can be made between Nibley as a critic and an advocate of a model of life that did not come with, you know, an instruction booklet alongside it.
Nice. And here are the 5 points on how to get there, a general authority address. Yeah,
he didn't do that, and he never pretended to have much interest in doing that. You know, he, you know, made it pretty clear that he saw himself as, you know, kind of flag waving, as it were. You know, see here, see here, see here, drawing people's attention to things, or trying to draw people's attention away from things. He wasn't telling them what to do with the thing that he was
right.
pointing to,
nice.
Or how to do anything with it. I think there's a connection between all of that and the comments that were made before about how, you know, people would hear his criticisms, or they would read his criticisms and internalize his criticisms and feel that they were so broad that they didn't really come home to the individual in the way that they might. So here's the thing. Like a lot of prophetic voices that come out of religious traditions, Nibley was very, very generous, very, very expansive in the targets that he subjected to his mockery, to his invitations to be better, to his posing of alternatives. And by being so broad, he didn't do as much as he might have been able to do in terms of building up a faction
that could
latch onto a programmatic response, like, we Mormon businessmen now need to do this. But it's not like he was ever talking to Mormon businessmen. He was talking to all of the saints.
But then guys like Warner Woodruff did pick up the
yes,
piece and Lucas and you know, working and, towards Zion,
you know,
and
that's,
things.
That's what I said before. There were people who picked up on, oh, I see how this applies to me, and they were able to respond in a way that really did kind of chart a program that others could follow, so that you could be a different sort of banker. You could be a different sort of political leader. You could be a different sort of father. You could be different.
Nice.
You know, you mentioned Martin Luther King before. I mean, okay, so let's make a contrast between Hugh Nibley and Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, from the beginning, was targeting particular people and trying to build a basis for programmatic change. Hugh Nibley was not doing that. Instead, he was speaking to anyone who would listen, and he was sending the same general message of chiding them, of inspiring them, of critiquing them, of suggesting alternatives to them, no matter who they were.
Awesome. Anybody else with anything more on this? Because we want to turn our attention to the nature of the critiques themselves. Let's name a few of them. Let's smile at many of them and things like that because of just the wit and et cetera. But Randy or Boyd, anything more in this general Hugh as prophet thing before we get more specific?
I would like to say that I really like what Russell just said. He put his finger on something that I've never been able to say quite as eloquently, and I think you were right there. So that, from my experience, that is what Hugh Nibley did. I would like to add that though we're going to be going in to talk about specifics, and I really want to go there, for me, the important thing about Hugh Nibley was that he cared about moving the heart of the reader and creating a change in that reader. And the way he seemed to do it was he made us laugh at ourselves, cry at ourselves. That broad approach to everyone was a method that really did change lives. You know, he that hath ears to hear heard. And so I want to say, just underscore that, that was done, I think, on purpose by him. It wasn't to... that was his method of changing, of being prophetic, was to change individuals and hope that those individuals would then go out and do likewise, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I just want to underscore that that wasn't a side issue for him. That is what he would always do. Even in class, even with his side comments in class where he make outrageous theological comments. I remember once we were in the Book of Mormon class, and he talked about Ron I. Mori Ankemer seeing the finger of the Lord, and he threw a side comment out, which means the Lord always had obviously had a resurrected body before he came to earth, you know, and then he just went on. And I went up to him afterward, said, "Can I come to talk to you about something?" And he said, "Yeah, come on in class into my office." I sat down in his office, which was notorious, as you all know, probably. Got boxes of 3x5 cards every place. And he said, "What do you want to talk about?" And I said, I heard you made this side comment. And he said, "Yeah, that was interesting, wasn't it? What else do you want to talk about?" In other words, I wanted him to elaborate.
Right.
I wanted him to lead me, you know, and take me into the deeper mysteries. No way was he going to do that. He wasn't going to defend his position. It was an opinion of his, and I had the scriptures. They were open to me like anybody else. You know, is there anybody else in the hall that wants to come in and talk? You're gone, Mr. Paul. And, you know, so then that almost brusque way of saying, "I put it out there for you. I'm not going to be your leader, right? I'm not going to create a school of thought here."
Nice. That fits with Alex Nibley in the first one talking about how his dad never gave him a direct answer to anything. He would just point him in a direction and go. And that's nice. That's very nice. So let's at least nail down some of the critiques for those who are coming to Nibley for the first time. And as pre-circulated, we kind of talked about maybe talking about the wider critiques of just the world, the direction it's going, you know, how it's lost its way, how it, you know, claims to be living Christian principles, and yet it seems to glorify war, doesn't run from war, and the various things, you know, environmentalism, conservationism, things like that. So let's kind of talk about it in that area. And then I think we're going to have the most fun when he sits there and tweaks us about our culture, or the culture of boredom, the culture of zeal, the culture of, you know, busy work and leaders instead of, or managers instead of leaders, and all sorts of things like that. So let's go with the wider cultural critique, not Mormon culture, but the bigger one. So how about I just do this? Each of you pick a favorite. I'll go through the lineup, and you each tell us one area, any Fenn quotes or ideas on it. Each of us can comment on yours, and then we'll just move through to the next person or something. So, Boyd, why don't I start with you? What's one of your favorite areas that he critiqued, just the wider culture that you could introduce?
Well, you know, the thing that really caught my attention when I was a young man was his discussion of Zion. And, you know, I think the thing that this kind of ties in with what Randy was saying, you know, a lot of times when we think of prophetic voices, we think of them being doom and gloom. And, you know, Hugh was very much an apocalyptic thinker. He was thinking about the end times an awful lot. But he was very optimistic. And, you know, when he criticized the accumulation of wealth and our modern consumerism, he wasn't just talking about the negatives. He was talking about this vision of Zion that he had, of this world of, you know, of plenty, of abundance, if we share. And and so, you know, that really caught my imagination very early as a young man. And I found it to particularly, you know, again, it was not just this, you know, anti-capitalism. It was this pro-kingdom of God, this pro, you know, other way of living that that if we could just abandon some of our preoccupations with materialism and the accumulation of wealth, that we could have a much more harmonious world.
And, cool. Now, you've done two things here. You've introduced the concept of Zion, and if I'm right, we're going to be coming back to that over and over again, because that's certainly going to be a big part of his critique of the Mormon culture, the ways that we, you know, we preach Zion, but we fail to really strive for it. But this idea of the apocalyptic and accumulation of wealth and all those different things there, that's the separate issue. So all along, guys, as you answer, you know, you're going to go ahead and assert that Hugh taught this. If you have sources or favorite articles or essays of his or something where these come out with, I want our listeners to all along be able to kind of know where they might read those. So, Boyd, is there a favorite one of yours or a couple of yours that where he really goes into materialism, consumer culture, and things like that as taking us really away from something important?
Absolutely. You know, I think one of the greatest ones was Work We Must, But the Lunch Is Free, a classic essay that, you know, where he asserted that everything here on earth is a gift, and it's given to us. We have it in abundance, and, you know, we have to work. He wasn't denying a kind of work ethic like a lot of people assume when you start talking about a kind of alternate to the traditional capitalist mode, but he was talking about, you know, that the lunch is free. We need to stop worrying about lunch and start thinking about how we can spend our days profitably. He gave an assignment to his class. I, like Russell, I sat in on his class. I never took it, but I sat in on his class, and one of his assignments was to imagine what you would do if you had 1,000 years to live and all expenses paid. You didn't have anything to worry about in terms of making money. You just, what would you do with your life if you didn't have to worry about that? And, you know, it was a wonderful little imaginative thing to think about, because really that's the situation he argues we're in. The lunch is provided. So that was a really powerful essay to me.
Cool. And I know, Russell, you noted that as his best essay.
I consider it to be, as I said before, I think it's a profound work of political theory. Not that it works out a politics or an economics or a sociology for Zion, but it lays down markers upon which a great deal of serious reflection can be built. He has things to say about independence, and this he ties to the notion of gifts. As Boyd already mentioned, gifts are central to his way of thinking. Spiritual gifts, gift of revelation, the whole dispensation of the fullness of times is a gift to us that we need to make use of. The Book of Mormon is a gift. And so by thinking about gifts and tying them to independence, he therefore leads us away from the individualism of the modern capitalist ethos, where independence is a product of work, it's a product of property, it's a product of ownership, but independence becomes a product of trust. It becomes a product of belonging and cooperation and acceptance. And this is a very different way of thinking that points you towards a different kind of economic and different kind of political model. I think that you can make connections to different types of classical Republican or agrarian thought. You can pull out important streams of localism and a critique of kind of a cosmopolitan or technocratic liberalism from his way of thinking. I mean, it's very, very fruitful. And it really comes back, again, as Boyd said, to this idea of gifts, that God has made us capable of living lives on earth. And we need to accept that. We need to love that. We need to share that. We don't need to prove it. We don't need to earn it. We don't need to make it. If we focus too much on earning and building and making, we miss the gifts. And if we miss the gifts, we miss the opportunity to truly love and cooperate and share with one another, because in the end, all of our sharing and all of our cooperating will be things that we do with our stuff, and we shouldn't be thinking about it that way. I mean, this is utopian thinking, and I'm using utopian not in a pejorative sense, but like, you know, referring to Leo Tolstoy or, you know, any number of utopian thinkers throughout history. It's utopian thinking in a very high level, a very, very demanding level.
Excellent. Randy, anything to... Well, and first of all, just Work We Must, Lunch is Free is in the collection called Approaching Zion, which is volume 9 of the Hugh Nibley Collected Works series. So I just didn't want to make sure we got that in there. But Randy, go ahead and reflect upon his critique here. I know you actually push back on Hugh a little bit. I don't know if you want to share that now or we can do a section later, but just anything more on his buildup of wealth and kind of consumerism.
I think we'll push back later. Right now, I want to pile on. I think if there is one theme that I never remember him explicitly stating, but I've come away from years of reading him and having taken courses from him and gone to hear Nibley, as we used to say back in the 60s, at many firesides or wherever you could catch him. If there was one undergirding theme for him, it was the problem of what you do forever. He really believed that we were eternal beings. And so he found, I think, it intriguing to think about what you would really desire to do forever, to become or to do forever in relationships. And it goes back to that thousand-year question, but it's what Russell called his deep critique, his deep utopian critique. It wasn't just a critique of this worldliness. It was a critique of the very idea of being divine beings who would live forever. It was a very interesting problem. He seemed, when I found it, a few of his essays, when he pushed to the edge, almost like Moses pushed God to the edge of, why are you doing this? And God says, it's my own business, thank you. But then he finally comes out and says, well, oh, all right, I'll give you a hint to bring the past, the immortality, the eternal life of man. But that's all you're getting out of me. Nibley, but Nibley would, on the purpose, the ultimate purpose thing, seemed to be, and he had an essay on where he talked about the goods of first and the goods of second intent. And he said that the problem in the world is we get so focused on the goods of second intent. In other words, the instrumental goods, the things we have to do to survive, that we don't realize how much the goods of first intent, what Russell called the gifts, the gifts are right there. They're always already right there. And the closest thing I think Hugh Nibley could come to describe those gifts of first intent would be art, drama. Anything that was creative, delightful. Anything that was art, that we are ultimately to be artists. That's the highest way of being divine. You collaborate with people in artful ways. He wanted to be Shakespeare. He knew he couldn't pull it off. Once said, you know, that was his, if he could be anybody, that's what he wanted to do, is right place. And there's something in that, of being the dramatist, of being the artist, who wanted to make eternity interesting, always interesting and delightful. So he would talk about the temple ceremony, and he underscored for me the first time where he talked about variety and beauty being the reason God says he created the earth, for variety and beauty, not for moral certitude. You know what I mean? Not even to make us better people. But there's this idea in him that when we get all through this, it's all going to be about delight. When he had his near-death experience, he said he clicked his heels. Listen to his words. He clicked his heels. He jumped in the air when he could do math equations in his head in a way that he never could do when he was immortal, when he had that near-death. Well, that tells you something about him. It was the delight in doing the math equations. It wasn't that the math equations themselves were going to make it possible for him to create a new earth. It was the fact that he could do them at all in a delightful way. So I think that this is the optimism you find in him, is that he senses that it's actually enjoyable to be a god, even though God weeps, even though God pain is in pain and all that, but there is something that he saw and he felt in the world that just was worth it forever and would always be interesting. So I want to just kind of underscore that it wasn't his antipathy toward business so much as the fact that, as Pascal would say, it was a divertissement. Business for too many people was getting in the way of seeing what was already there, right? In fact, I remember when I left my business career, I went to talk with you, Nibley, about what I should do next. I had a couple of ideas, and he looked at me, gave me the help I needed, and he leaned back and finally realized that I was leaving a business career. And he said, "What? I've never known anybody to leave a business career."
Wow.
This is very unusual. You know, he almost didn't have words for it. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm just doing it. I want to do this other stuff." And he again was befuddled. It didn't fit his model that a businessman could not be blinded by business to see that there was more already right there for him to enjoy in the world. That's maybe one of the areas where he was a little blind with his own stereotype. Nevertheless, I've gone at length on this because I think it's very important that we understand that he was not in any sense impractical. He just felt like that the practical could get in the way too often of our realization of what's already there. The abundant life is all in front of it. Zion is here now if we want to make it that way. We can live the law of consecration now. We don't have to defer it, nor do we have to have it necessarily in some perfect social order. I don't think he would have gotten out in front of any program that he would have called the final social way or the final economic system. He might have been an experimenter, but there was something about him that sensed, knowing now the beauty that is there around us to appreciate, is what the abundant life of the gods is. I'll just shut up there for now.
Thank you. Thank you. Not thank you for shutting up. thank you for the reflection.
I deserve that.
No, not at all. That's so funny. Anyway, hey, Donamy, Boyd mentioned a little bit about the near-death experience in the biographical one, and Randy, you mentioned here. Where has he written about it? I should have asked you back then, Boyd. Is it in any of his essays, or how does the word of this experience get out?
I don't think it is in any of his essays. He talks about it, though, on film, in the film that Alex made called Faith of an Observer. And that film's still available. In fact, I was buying one for a friend the other day, and it's like $10 or something. It's really quite cheap.
Nice. So through Maxwell Institute or what?
I got it at Deseret Book.
Okay.
It's a really beautifully done documentary. They did it back in 1985, I believe, for his 75th birthday. And he discusses that in great detail there. It's also a nice introduction to, Hugh's work, his themes, and his, you know, the themes he dealt with and his life in general. It's a beautifully done documentary.
The complete documentary is available on YouTube.
Yeah, oh, really? For free?
And it's not complete. It's in parts. But, yeah, the whole thing
okay,
is...
Okay, you can add it together and it makes it. Oh, neat. Yeah. Well, that's good. And, Randy, is that your source for this, or was it other things for what you talked about?
I either heard him talk about it in the fireside or on that video. Boy, do you remember if he used the word click his heel in the video? You know, he was jumping for joy.
He says something like that in the video, yeah. He was very reluctant to talk about that, so it was kind of a surprise that they got it on film, because he was very reluctant to talk about some of these more mystical experiences in public, you know, and so that was one of the few places that I think you find it.
Well, the other thing on that film, while we're at it, I would highly recommend to your listeners, Dan, to get that film or to see it, because it's the one place I went to hear Nibley a lot, and I never saw him tear up. But on that film, they've got him actually emotionally very intensely involved, where he's talking about the story of Abraham receiving the blessing he prayed for all his life to have a son, only after he had sacrificed, so to speak, and gone out to help others. I won't ruin the story.
No.
You need to see it on the film. But it's a very moving moment. And it's another theme of Hugh Nibley, that hospitality is the symbol of Christ. It's the symbol of what we should be to other people. And only through showing hospitality will we end up getting the blessing that we want the most. So it's in the process of serving others we discover the gold that we thought we'd have to be digging in another place. That's one of his themes that he liked to talk about all the time.
Awesome. And just to let you know, Randy, we did talk about that piece of where he got emotional too, and Alex was able to tie that in. The Nibleys lost a child at about 5 or 6 months pregnancy, and it would have been a boy, and they would have named him Isaac. And so there was a piece of that. There was a piece of that also in that came out in our first one. So, but yeah, but certainly the hospitality stuff is absolutely dead on as well. So. But yeah, it was kind of neat, poignant.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.